From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. He doesn't do it all the time, but there's this thing the professor and geneticist Daniel Fairbanks does in his lectures that adds another dimension to the information, literally. Fairbanks teaches biology at Utah Valley University. He also happens to be a pretty accomplished sculptor, and he will manipulate a clump of clay while he teaches. So when he's talking about the way the human skull and facial features began to vary as we evolved, he can show students exactly what he means, or at least convey the idea of incremental change as he's sculpting a bust of Charles Darwin. Today in the program, Professor Fairbanks is with us to talk about human evolution. His latest book gathers the overwhelming evidence of it, but he also makes the case for why it matters. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the biologist Daniel Fairbanks is joining us to make the case for human evolution. In his book, he goes through the overwhelming evidence that humans evolved over time. And you can see that evidence, he says, in our bodies, in our genome, on the Earth, in our geography. But he's also trying to explain why all of this matters, because there are enough Americans who are still skeptical, who are making it difficult, he says, for science teachers around the country. But also because, he says, the lessons we've learned from evolution can help us meet the challenges of modern life, drought and poverty and disease and climate change. In fact, he says, our future depends on how we use our understanding of evolution. Daniel Fairbanks is with us today. We invite you to join the conversation as well. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Daniel Fairbanks is a geneticist, dean of the Utah Valley University College of Science and Health, where he's also a professor of biology, as I mentioned. He's written several books. The most recent, the one we're going to be talking about today, is Evolving, the Human Effect and Why It Matters. We also will point out, because we'll talk about this a little bit, that he's from a family of renowned artists, the Fairbanks name you may know. He's also a sculptor and a painter. He illustrated his book with his own hand-drawn or computer-generated images. Daniel Fairbanks, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, we're going to come back to this, but I guess I wanted to begin with a story you tell early in this latest book about how you were attending a workshop for high school science teachers and how I guess you were noticing these kind of conflicting emotions. On one hand, there's this excitement for science and wanting to engage with students on this question, but also you say they felt weary and embattled. What do you mean? What were you saying there?
Well, the issue has to do with the acceptance of evolution. Evolution really is the underpinning theory of modern biology. And yet there are some people who find it very difficult to accept the scientific evidence of that. And where that really comes to a head is in the public schools, I think more so than at universities. I've had very little trouble when we teach evolution at universities. But as we work with the public school teachers who are science teachers, they oftentimes face that tension between what the science tells us and what parents or school administrators
or religious leaders
want to have children learn, and so it's now really is, I think, the most exciting time to be a scientist, and especially a biologist with all the things that are going on. And so much of that really is related to that underpinning theme of evolution. And yet teachers in the public schools oftentimes face that challenge on how do they present science as science. And what it really is, and yet also deal with the issues that come up when people perceive any inclusion of evolution as a threat.
Yeah, a threat to faith, threat mm-hmm. to their ideas yeah. Of God or whatever. But you write about how the pace of all this information, as you mentioned, it's an incredibly exciting time to be a scientist.
It is.
But you say that the pace of it can be a little overwhelming, and you say it's left the general public in some ways unaware of just how extensive and how deep the evidence is. What do you mean? We're just – we can't keep up with all of the information.
Well, even as a specialist in the area, I have trouble keeping up with it all.
Yeah.
It is a very rapid-paced situation. And as a and then the other real challenge, and one of the reasons I've written popular books, is that the information becomes so technical that it's very difficult to bring it to explain it in a way that those who don't have an extensive background in the sciences can really grasp it and understand it and evaluate the evidence that's there. And for me, I find that both a challenge and I think also a delight. It's something I really find satisfaction in being able to share science with those who may not have a natural propensity for it, or even more so, I think those who have an aversion to science, mm. hopefully changing that aversion to something where they may not become lovers of science, but they at least it's not as frightening as it once was.
But what's the trick for a scientist who also, as you said, you wrote – it was interesting the word you used, popular books. Mm-hmm. They're very different from academic journals, and I'm not sure there is an area of study that's more Byzantine and complicated mm-hmm. than biology, it seems to me anyway. But that's important to you. What's the trick of conveying such complicated information, synthesizing it and making it understandable to even you know everybody else?
I think there are two things. One is getting beyond the jargon.
Yeah.
It's so easy as a scientist to use the terms that scientists are familiar with and fail to remember that these are terms that not everyone understands. And then I think the second one is recognizing that what admittedly is a very complex thing is perhaps not as complex as we really think it is. Mm-hmm. And that is that the basic ideas, the basic underpinnings that are there are really understandable. They are things that we can grasp. They're things that make sense. And just by learning a little bit of the jargon or learning a little bit of where things are going, the story can get through. And I think I really admire science journalists. I think they do a very good job of that sort of thing, of sharing the excitement as well as oftentimes the accuracy of science and the meaning and getting to, as the book says, why does it matter to us? I think that more than anything captures people's attention. Why does that matter to me? Why does it make a difference in my life or the lives of my family or the world in general? Seeing that pertinence, I think, makes a difference, because then people do take an interest in it and it does become fascinating.
Yeah. You make this reference to your childhood in mm-hmm. your book. Grew up in – you mentioned this kind of idyllic place where you grew up.
Yeah, it's actually not too far from where we're sitting
I was going to say, right. Lots of open fields nearby and mm-hmm. Streams and that – I guess this idea of nature, connecting with it. You raised a lot of different animals as a mm-hmm. kid, wandered around the foothills probably a lot, right?
Not so much the foothills as just in the immediate vicinity I was. It was very close to Forestdale Golf Course.
Well, so but I guess the point is nature was a pretty powerful influence for.
Oh, absolutely!
For you,
it really when my friends were off playing little league baseball or soccer, I was usually hiding behind the grass, watching animals come out by a pond, and not long ago, I discovered a drawing that I made when I was 7 years old of the first monarch butterfly that I raised from a larva, and those to me, that was just absolute fascination. I'd go to the library, check out the same book every time. It was a book on scientific experimentation, and it had a number of experiments that I could do at home. And so just from the time I was young, this connection with nature, this connection with science just seemed to be a natural part of who I was. And in fact, when we talked a little bit about the art was too. I was always drawing, and so bringing art and science together was just a natural part of who I was.
Did it seem natural, both of those things?
Oh, absolutely.
Really? You didn't see I've got to either be a sculptor or I've got to be a geneticist?
Oh, no. In fact, as a child, I never really thought of it.
Is that right?
I, of course, grew up in an artist, in an environment with artists. My father, my grandfather were both famous sculptors, an uncle who was a painter. And so the smell of linseed oil and the smell of oil-based clay, those are the sorts of things that are childhood memories that come back every time I walk into an artist's studio or my own studio. Mm-hmm. And to me, they were the idea of going into nature and drawing what's there and seeing seeing what we might call the artistic part of science, mm-hmm. of what's there in nature. They really never were separate realms within my mind. And as I've grown older, the temptation in education, I think, is really to separate the two, to become highly specialized. And I've tried to resist that. I've tried to keep that childhood connection that I had between the two, and I think done so pretty successfully.
Maybe that explains then this tradition that you've taken on, that your grandfather began, where he would sculpt while mm-hmm. he spoke publicly. Your father did this too. Now you're doing it. These sculpture lectures where you take these – and I mentioned this in the introduction earlier on. You take this big clump of clay and you begin to create a form as you're talking. And generally by the end of it, it's not complete. I mean, you probably would spend a lot more time at it. But you certainly have the sense that here is a form. Here is a face. So it seems like there's a lot going on there. On one hand, it seems like that's your effort to combine – science and art,
yes,
right there,
course.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's also it also seems like that part of it is to convey, as I said in that introduction earlier, incremental change. Here it is coming forth. And I mean, when did you strike on that? As I know it's a tradition in mm-hmm. the family, but what are you getting at with that?
Well, it's as any sort of presentation is that. A visual component that's associated with it oftentimes helps convey the message better than just the words themselves. Yeah. And then the other thing I think that makes this the sculpture lectures so effective is that they are so unusual. There really are not a lot of people who do that sort of thing, and most people find it amazing that within a half hour I can have a head pretty far along.
Yeah,
and yet for me it doesn't seem all that amazing because I grew up watching it, and so it was just a natural part of following a family tradition and doing that. And yet at the same time, I remember people just swarming around my grandfather and my father after these lectures thinking, this is really fascinating. And I thought, gee, it'd really be cool to do that too. And so I did pick it up later on, and it has become a very effective way of getting the message across that I want to convey in a whole variety of settings.
Yeah.
I'll do it not just for science. Matt Holland, who's president of Utah Valley University, and he and I do a Martin Luther King Jr. presentation, for instance, or an Abraham Lincoln. And but it is a very effective, unforgettable experience for those who are in the audience to see that. And for me, it's actually easier than just giving a standard PowerPoint presentation because my mind is so focused on doing the sculpture that – and I obviously can't have a written text in front of me as I'm doing it because I have to watch the sculpture.
Yeah.
And so I just simply say what comes to mind. And it to me is a more relaxing, more natural way of giving a public presentation than understand the standard presentation in front of a microphone. I kind of wish I had one right here that I could be working on now.
I bet. There's a Russian biologist or Ukrainian biologist, maybe both, I guess, Theodosius Dobzhansky. And you mention him in the book and describe him as this kind of kindred spirit man who emigrated to the United States. And that, I think it was the 1920s, I guess it was, prominent evolutionary biologist and geneticist like yourself. And he wrote this paper, you say, in your latest book, which sort of summed it all up for you, that evolution is the central theme of life. Talk about that.
Yeah, the title of the article was Nothing in Biology Makes Sense Except in the Light of Evolution. And most biologists would agree with that, that evolution is the underlying theme that defines modern biology. And so when we look at things like the applications of biology, medicine, agriculture, environmental issues, all of those have an underpinning in the evolution of life. And there are many explanations of natural phenomena that we either observe in nature or that we may exploit for food production or for improving our health that are fully explainable as evolutionary phenomena. And particularly with in my own area of expertise, which is genetics, the development of the genomics and the human genome and those sorts of things, the more we get into that and even right down into the details of it, the more the evolutionary history is evident. It's written in our DNA, written almost literally in the sense that our DNA is made up of a digital alphabet.
Yeah.
And as one who works directly with that in my own research, I see have discovered in my own research the evolutionary history that's there. It really is written there. And much of it is still waiting to be discovered.
I'm trying to get a sense of what you were trying to do with this book, because in some ways what you're doing is you're saying, hey, here's the evidence for evolution, which is an incredibly daunting task. And it's been done a lot, right? I mean, there's a lot of people who sort of try to express the evidence for evolution. And it's territory, as I said, that's been covered.
Well, not entirely.
Really?
If you look at most evolution books, they deal a lot with the fossil evidence and the anatomical evidence because those are things that we can easily see.
Yeah.
It's easy to communicate those sorts of things and people tend to grasp them fairly well. What was lacking in other books was the evidence from DNA. And because that's my area of expertise, that's what I've tried to focus on in the two books that I've done on it.
So you're unifying all of these points.
Well, my first book, Relics of Eden, was focused entirely on the DNA, and then I thought, let's bring it all together.
Yeah.
And so what I tried to do with Evolving is say, here's the evidence in a nutshell. You can look at this and really I can't summarize all of the evidence. It's just a sampling of what's there.
Of course, of course.
But these are examples of the evidence that shows that we evolved. And then the question that always comes up is, so what?
Yeah.
Does it matter? And that's what this book is unique about, is that the second half of the book says, okay, we've found the evidence. Here it is that shows that humans have evolved. And now, what does it mean?
Yeah.
Does it have any meaning to the person who doesn't spend a lot of time studying science? And the latter half of that book really tells why it does matter, why we should care about it, because it really does have meaning and an influence on many aspects of our lives.
Daniel Fairbanks is with us. He is Dean of the College of Science and Health at Utah Valley University, author of the book Evolving, The Human Effect and Why It Matters. And we invite you to join us if you like, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us Utah geneticist and biologist and artist Daniel Fairbanks. You might recognize that last name. Comes from a well-known family of Utah artists, famous sculptors, his father, his grandfather. And art does play a role in the way he explores science, but his new book is about evolution, about human evolution and how we've changed as a species over time, but also why that matters. The book is called Evolving, The Human Effect and Why It Matters. And you can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Well, you obviously loved Charles Darwin. You tell the story about a colleague of Charles Darwin, or maybe a competitor, Alfred Russel Wallace. We've actually done a whole show about him. He was a terrific character. But he had this exchange with Charles Darwin. They were writing these letters back and forth about their theories and their ideas. And he asked this really critical question of Charles Darwin, which you mention in your book. He wanted to know whether in his book, this is Alfred Russel Wallace, he wanted to know of Darwin, in your book, The Origin of the Species, are you going to include human evolution? Which was a pretty big, probably taboo at the time, probably still is in a lot of ways. And Darwin sort of demurs, right? I mean, he says, I think I shall avoid the whole subject. But that is the question, right? I mean, human evolution, I mean, that – is it still dicey? Is it still a taboo?
I think it depends on to whom you're talking.
Yeah.
For some people, yes. It can be challenging. It can be disturbing. It can disrupt long-held views that people have, and based on the creationist movement that's underway right now, or probably more commonly now, the intelligent design movement, it has become a challenge to science education. For most scientists, it's not a challenge at all. Interestingly, I've had taught evolution my entire career and never had much trouble dealing with students.
And we should point out, though, the context for that is you taught for a good many years at Brigham Young University.
Sure. Yeah, 20 years.
And I think that might surprise some people that someone who talked about unequivocally about human evolution and the way the human, human beings evolved didn't have a problem at a Mormon university. And that's probably a whole show, the Mormon view on evolution. But maybe you could say something about that because that's pretty interesting.
Well, it's interesting to look at where scientists come from. In fact, I'd like to take it even a little broader than just Mormonism and look at views of scientists in general. First of all, if you go to BYU. Biologists there teach biology pretty much the same way that it's taught everywhere. They are good scientists. They follow the scientific method. There is nothing that really distinguishes a BYU biologist from a biologist anywhere. It is a good, solid university in what it does. And if we look broadly at scientists have as many different religious or secular views as there are scientists out there. And yet what we find is that when it comes to dealing with science, we focus on the evidence and say, what does the evidence tell us? In fact, a good scientist tries – I think it's impossible to entirely do this, but a good scientist tries to divorce herself or himself from the from any biases from the outside and say, let's look at the evidence, let's interpret the evidence
It's a pretty powerful bias if you're a religious person and you're under this impression that the Earth is only 10,000 years old, or that this idea that humans didn't come created fully formed.
Well,
that's a pretty powerful bias that comes into.
Yeah, and yet if you look at religion, there's such a broad range of interpretations.
Of course,
what we refer to as young Earth creationism, which is a very literal interpretation of the first few chapters of Genesis, as opposed to a more metaphorical or broader view that we might look at it. And we see the same sort of thing in other religious traditions as well, especially the Western ones that all rely on that early Judeo-Islamic Christian view of creation. And yet we can go back to some of the earliest Christian theologians and see that even they did not look at it in a strictly literal sense, that they looked at it in a much more in a much broader metaphorical way. And I think that if we get beyond that strict literal interpretation, which I think most people nowadays are willing
to. You think
that's
where we're headed?
I think so.
Yeah.
That then the conflict between science is not as acute as it is if we do take that strictly literal point of view,
because you can accommodate both of the ideas,
and it goes beyond biology too. It's not just biology.
No, right.
It affects all of science and delves into the social sciences and those sorts of things as well. But
it kind of gets us to something that you do reference in the book early on, this Gallup poll from a few years ago, which essentially said that, if I understand it, roughly 40% of Americans reject the idea that we evolved, that human beings evolved. Now, that's a pretty significant
minority.
Yeah.
And it's much higher in the United States than it is in many other places.
Right.
I'm very interested to see where that goes as more scientific information becomes available to the public. You know, how willing are people to explore other options or to challenge what might be long-held beliefs that they've had. It's one of the challenges that university professors have in general, which is we want students to think critically. You know, critical thinking is a big part of what universities do. And what we hope students will do is that they will look carefully at the evidence and learn how to evaluate evidence, look at evidence and say, this seems pretty shaky to me, this seems pretty solid. That's a difficult skill to acquire, and yet I think it's one of the most important skills that students can gain as part of their education.
You have talked about before anyway, and it's not part of the book, but you have talked about the day that you were quote unquote converted, which is a loaded word in this state, but converted to not to religion but to Darwin. January of 1979, it was a class in Brigham Young University, and I think you had probably a fairly conventional sort of Christian view of evolution, which was maybe skeptical or couldn't quite figure out how it worked, but something important happened on this January day of 1979 in this
class. It was a course taught by a great professor and it was on vertebrate zoology, and the whole course was based on evolution. And that to me was a bit of a shock. And being this, you know, being in January, it was early in the semester when this came about. And I remember going up to him after class and saying, thank you for the lecture. It was a transformational experience. And he perceived at that moment, he said, why don't you come to my office and let's talk a little bit more? And so I did. And then his name was Clayton White, a fantastic professor. And he said, then there's someone you need to meet. And he took me to meet Duane Jeffrey, who was an evolutionary geneticist. And the two of them, along with others, helped me shape my career. And both of them are continue to be very close and dear friends.
But wait, what was the epiphany? That it was that all of a sudden now you could that they didn't have to be incompatible, your ideas of God or your ideas of the past and And this thing that you now were able to make them work together, is that it?
I think it was more a case of understanding what scientific evidence is and how to interpret it. Huh. That's really what the focus of the course was, is here's the evidence.
And, now, and how it's do we, just, now, how this do is
we,
what it is.
Yeah, and how do we best explain it? And I had been, of course, interested in nature and from the time I was a child. But this was a point when the whole idea of what science is gelled. It began to make sense to me. And that was – I'd maybe consider myself to be a scientist from the time I was a child. But that was the time when I really became a modern scientist. I really grasped the idea of what we sometimes call either the scientific method, or it's more common now to call it the nature of science. That is, how do we evaluate evidence? How do we do experimentation, hypothesis testing, those sorts of things? That was being able to see that evidence and see how the evidence was interpreted and how it made sense. That was really what the epiphany was.
Here's an email that comes from Floyd, who writes from Lehigh, "Why are we even engaging creationists on this topic in the first place? The argument should only exist within the realm of science, meaning that every time we decide to engage creationists or evolution deniers, we give them and their ideas some sort of credibility." Well, you don't really engage creationism.
No, I don't. In fact, in evolving, one of the things I did there is I said, you know, I've expressed my views on this before. We're done. Let's deal with the evidence. Let's look at the scientific evidence, and the point being that it doesn't necessarily have to be a threat.
Yeah.
That and interestingly, people, scientists with a variety of views, ranging from Stephen Jay Gould, who was really pretty much indifferent to religion personally, to someone like Francis Collins, who is an evangelical Christian, they all really say the same thing. Which is this
What's
doesn't
evidence?
Yeah, it doesn't need to be a threat. Let's deal with the evidence, and so I agree. We don't really need to engage the creationism movement, except for the fact that it does oftentimes influence education.
Let's take a call. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Brad is with us in Salt Lake. Brad, welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to present a couple observations and get the guest reaction. I teach evolutionary anthropology at a university level. And one observation is that students who are resistant to the idea of evolution, when you push on it, they're not really resistant to the idea of microevolution at all, the idea that gene frequency changes in populations over time. But what they're really resistant to is the idea that evolutionary change described that way can lead to speciation, can lead to different kinds of species, different, fundamentally different kinds of organisms. So that tends to be the real hang-up. The other thing that I've noticed is that, and this is kind of piggybacking on the earlier observation that evolution is just so central to all modern biology, is kind of pushing that forward one more step and noting and explaining to the students that it's central to life itself. And the way we do that is we kind of brainstorm as a class, what does it mean to be alive? And we typically arrive at the conclusion together that all living organisms do three things. They metabolize, they reproduce, and they die. Which means that because they do those three things, they also do a fourth thing. They evolve. So we're not just saying that living things can evolve. We're saying that living things can't not evolve. Life is a nonsensical concept without evolution, and life and evolution are synonyms of each other.
Yeah.
So I'd love to hear the response, and I'm happy to take it off air. Thanks, Brad.
Yeah, first of all, I'd like to address the microevolution, macroevolution issue, which is we humans have, it seems to me, an innate propensity to categorize things into discrete categories when in fact it's really a continuum.
Yeah, and it's all one big category.
Yeah. Well, the idea is that what we might call microevolution, changes in gene frequency, changes in DNA mutation, all of those sorts of things, is just a matter of degree before we get to speciation, which is what we call macroevolution.
But what Brad is saying is that students are cool with the fact that finches have different kinds of beaks, that bats have evolved in certain ways. But if you try to make the connection that humans – and bats and finches all came from one sort of common life form millions and millions of years ago, that's harder to imagine.
And that's I think, where the DNA evidence becomes really critical, because there we're getting right down to the most essential part of evolution, because ultimately what everything in evolution is based on is changes in DNA. And then all of the other things like natural selection and genetic drift and anything else that comes into play is how that DNA ends up being transmitted from one generation to the next and how organisms interact with one another. But it's interesting that when we get into the DNA itself and start to compare them among different species, the evolutionary history that is fully explainable by what we might call the microevolution is evident at that level among different species. We can see in my books, for instance, I deal quite a bit with the comparison of humans and chimpanzees. And now, of course, we have the Neanderthal genome that's available, which only augments this even more. And we can take the DNA of those organisms and compare it, and the evolutionary history is now becomes much more detailed. We can see not only that it happened. In fact, among scientists, there's really not much question that it did happen. The question is, how did it happen? And now we're getting to the point where we can answer some of those questions about how it happened in really remarkably fine detail. A lot of what I do is I work with specific genes and look at the evolution of that one gene and how what does it do? And but then the other point that came up later is about what is life and how do we explain evolution with that gets to the point that I was talking about earlier about why does it matter? The sorts of things that this is Brad, right?
Yeah, Brad.
Brad is teaching is a really engaging way, I think, to teach students, because it gets them thinking on their own, and using the evidence that's there, they draw what ultimately is the inevitable conclusion, which is that life, because of its very nature, evolves.
I'm going to probably vastly oversimplify this for a moment, but one of the questions you get to is you sort of go through the evidence of evolution, evidence from our bodies, evidence from geography, and we don't have time to get through all of these. Incredibly complicated. But one of the things you mentioned, for example, the evidence of evolution. Look at our eyes. That's evidence. Or look at our pelvis. The way it evolved. That's a kind of evidence. But if in the beginning there was this sort of common life form or common ancestor, and over the course of millions of years we changed, there's also evidence in other creatures, you know, that you write about, that we have a similar connection, for example, to four limbs of a bat and four limbs of a dolphin and four limbs of a human. They have the same kinds of elements. And that is evidence, but that's freaky for people who have a certain sort of religious perspective. That, I mean, do you know what I mean? That's so it's so interesting. I mean, how do you deal with that?
Well, first of all, the evidence that's there is we can see it very easily.
Yeah.
If you look at your arm, and there's one bone, call it the humerus, and then there's the radius and ulna, two bones, and the way. His name is slipping my mind now. Neil Shubin put it in his book, Your Inner Fish. He says there's one bone, two bones, a bunch of little bones, which are the bones in the wrist, and then typically the five digits, but sometimes those are reduced in number. And if you look at a chicken wing, you know, in a restaurant, it has the same structure that's there. And the same thing in a bat's wing. And interestingly, even in a horse's forelimb, what we call the horse's knee has a bunch of little bones because that's the that's what we say that's homologous to the wrist, even though it carries out a different function. And where we have two bones just above that, the horse has a single one. But if you go in and look at it closely, there's a groove there. There were two bones there originally that during horse evolution have fused. And so the we can say, well, this common pattern that we see among among animals, we can either look at it as something that's just completely independent, but scientifically a much more logical explanation is that this is evidence of common ancestry.
Well, vestiges are another one that you write about.
Oh, yeah. And vestiges are
And let me explain what that is. I mean, you know, it's this evidence that there are these remnants of structures that creatures didn't need, so were diminished, but they remain. A dog's dew claw.
Yeah, dew claw on a dog is
an ostrich wing,
a quintessential example of it. And yet we have them ourselves. And the placa luminaris in the eye, which is the remnant of an eyelid that moves horizontally, which we can see in some animals, reptiles especially.
Yeah.
We have the remnant of it there. It no longer no longer functions in us. And there are a number goosebumps is another one. Those are the we get goosebumps when we're nervous, when we're afraid, or when we're cold. And with animals, with mammals, that's the mechanism for raising the hair. And of course, we don't have the hair to raise. Well, little tiny hairs in each of those goosebumps, but it's a remnant of our evolutionary history. And so, those are just fascinating bits of our anatomy that are there. But what's interesting is we find the same sort of vestiges in our DNA, genes that once carried out a function that no longer do, and yet they're still there. And so that the vestiges that we see anatomically, we see the same sort of thing in our DNA and can see the mechanisms that left those there and also how they've changed over time.
Daniel Fairbanks is with us, geneticist, dean at the College of Science and Health at Utah Valley University, author of the book Evolving, The Human Effect and Why It Matters. Brad, thanks very much for the call. 801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Peter, I'm going to ask you to call back if you would, because I thought your question was a good one. 801-585-WEST, the number. We need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio, back now with Utah geneticist and artist Daniel Fairbanks. We're talking about his latest book, Evolving, The Human Effect and Why It Matters. 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Peter called back. Peter, thanks. From Salt Lake City, welcome.
Thank you. I am interested in the definition of the word creationist. Does that include someone who thoroughly believes in evolution but also believes that evolution was the tool that God used for creation?
You know, that said, this whole idea of the semantics of that word have been bantered around for some time. You know, some people will say creationist with a large C and creationist with a small c,
right.
Or there's another term, theistic creationist. And so it's like many words. It's used in a number of different contexts and by a number of different people in various ways. And so what's sometimes referred to as theistic evolution is the idea that that people will have a belief in God and believe that that God had a hand in creation, but used evolution as the mechanism for it, and as opposed to what is sometimes called young Earth creationism, which is a much more literal view of a highly supernatural origin of life. And so the word creationism or creationist gets used in a number of contexts and in a number of different ways. But and so I think it's often important to look at what the context is when someone is using that word.
So let's shift to – I mean, you go through evidence. I mentioned evidence of evolution that we get from our bodies. You mentioned evidence from the Earth, the fossil record. You work through a lot of that. Evidence from geography, which is interesting. You write about language. DNA, of course, it's a critical factor for you. Evidence from our genome, you write about that. But one of the things you also sort of get to is this question of why it matters. And since we're running out of time, I wanted to get to that idea because you say that that the idea is that we need to learn to take these lessons from evolution and figure out how to adapt, how to deal with the challenges of modern life. That the, you know, all the stuff that we know about evolution should help us deal with, you know, global climate change and poverty and drought and hunger and all those kinds of things. Say something about that, if you would.
Sure. I think the example that most people may be familiar with is the emergence of what are sometimes called superbugs. We're talking here about bacteria.
Yeah.
That hospitals now may have disease-causing bacteria that are resistant to antibiotics because we've used them so much. And that's a predictable outcome under an evolutionary scenario, that natural selection will favor the few individuals that are capable of surviving, and they then produce offspring that carry – that provided that ability to survive and resist the antibiotic is genetic, then they will pass that on to their offspring, and it's a classic case of natural selection. Another one that I just read about a week ago was the emergence of herbicide-resistant weeds as farmers have adopted the so-called Roundup-ready crops, which was a huge revolution in farming, a recent one that most people are maybe not entirely familiar with. But it's making the crops genetically resistant to an herbicide means the farmer can go and spray the herbicide, kill all of the weeds, and the crop survives. But the inevitable consequence of that under an evolutionary scenario
is
that there will be – yeah, change. Yeah. Is that a weed that out of the millions of weeds that are out there, one of them is going to be genetically resistant. And as soon as it grows and produces seeds, then the seeds – carry that trait with them, and before long you have weeds that, like the crop, are resistant to the herbicide, and then it becomes ineffectual.
It's one of the points that you make in the book, that we have shaped the evolution of plants and the evolution of animals. I mean, breeding, all those kinds of things. We've been using evolution.
Oh, yeah. We hear concern over genetically modified crops, and yet we as humans have been genetically modifying the plants and animals that we use for food for thousands of years through artificial selection, by selecting certain characteristics in them that make them useful for us. And then in more recent times, that's morphed into modern plant and animal breeding, and then lately into actually transferring genes from one species to another, which is technically what a genetically modified organism is. But we've been directing evolution in the species that we use for food and other uses. Dogs, for instance, is a great example, since prehistoric times. And so we have a tremendous impact on the world around us. And even those species that are not domesticated, that are wild, the way we manage our land, the way we live our lives, the species that interact with us evolve along with us. And that's not a new thing either. We see plenty of examples of coevolution between a plant and the insects that pollinate it. How those have evolved together, and we are co-evolving along with the organisms that we affect. I think the key in why does that matter is that we have to be careful in the way we manage these.
Yeah.
Antibiotic resistance is a very good example. If we use the same antibiotic over and over and over, then it won't take long for resistant organisms to appear. But if we use –
because this is just what they do. They will evolve. In the depth.
It's classic Darwinian natural selection. Yeah. And we see examples of it over and over. But if, on the other hand, we use a variety of antibiotics and we're careful on how those are prescribed, then it makes it much more difficult for those microorganisms to evolve in that way and have the resistance, and the antibiotics remain effective for a much longer period of time. But the inevitable result is that natural selection will take over, and it's important for us to understand that.
Well, you talk about antibiotics and you talk about pesticides and you talk about sort of those as evolving functions. I wonder if we can identify something that's a little bit more abstract in terms of human behavior. And there's a terrific question that comes from Mary Lloyd, who writes from St. George. She says, what about behavior, and most recently the popularity of communicating via email and text rather than in person? She says, are we humans evolving toward avoiding interpersonal interactions, and what could that mean? Which is a very specific question, but there's a bigger, broader question in there, and that is our behavior evolving as we interact with modern technology?
I think that's probably still an open question.
Sure.
There are two ways again, this gets to semantics. When we look at the word evolving, evolving oftentimes means just change.
Yeah.
But for it to be biological evolution, we have to see genetic change. It has to be passed on in a heritable fashion. And dealing with things like social media and texting and those sorts of things,
they
haven't been around long enough to – I mean, they many of them haven't been around for a generation yet. They haven't been around long enough for us
to
see
natural
selection having any effect on favoring particular variants in our DNA that are passed on then to offspring. And so, no, that's not really a biological evolution. And yet it is certainly a tremendous evolution of technology, based in part on the evolution of our brains and what they can do. You know, that's one of the characteristics about humans, is that we have a very unique way of working with our brains. And it's that evolution of our brains that has allowed us to develop the technology we have. But is that technology causing us to genetically evolve right now? Maybe 100 generations from now, yes, but not
right now.
Not right away.
Daniel Fairbanks. His book is called Evolving: The Human Effect and Why It Matters. Professor, thanks very much for being
here.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.